from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up in our Forum Hour Ahead, poet, essayist, and naturalist Diane Ackerman's new book, The Human Age, is a reflection of how people have changed the planet. She writes, quote, "Our relationship with nature has changed radically, irreversibly, but by no means all for the bad," end of quote. And while humans have subdued 75% of the land's surface, we have collected DNA of vanishing species, manufactured body organs from 3D prints, and gone to great lengths to restore ecosystems. She joins the program after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In her newest book, The Human Age, The World Shaped by Us, award-winning poet, author, and naturalist Diane Ackerman calls us, human beings, nomads with restless minds and powerful agents of planetary change. She also says our relationship with nature has changed radically, irreversibly, but by no means all for the bad. Our new epoch is laced with inventions. Our mistakes are legion, but our talent is immeasurable. It's a direct quote, and she, the author of The Zookeeper's Wife and A Natural History of the Senses and a number of children's books, as well as A Natural History of Love, which became a five-hour PBS series she hosted, has taught at both Columbia and Cornell, has been on Forum before, and joins us for the second hour this morning, and delighted to have you back with us. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Actually, I was looking on the internet, and I saw a picture of both of us at an old Kidney Foundation luncheon looking.
I know just the picture you
mean.
You
know the picture I'm talking about. Yeah, we both have nice smiles on our face, and it's always a smile to have you here.
Thank you.
And I'm smiling for another reason. Your book gives us some hope. In fact, a number of those who have already commented, I think Jared Diamond called it optimistic and enormously hopeful. Let me be literally perhaps the devil's advocate here. You know, with all the talk of climate change and of extinction of species being perhaps imminent, we've had Elizabeth Colbert on talking about that, and all the ecological disasters that we face, pollution and so forth. Where's the hope?
It's very, very easy these days to feel doomed. I think you're right. The media just showers us with so much bad news. And I think we have created a lot of planetary chaos that we didn't really mean to and that we're going to have to fix and right away. Climate change is real and we need to act immediately to restore the environment. But, you know, we've already proven that we can change the world, not for the better. We have the talent and the technologies to change it again, though. And this time, we can make it better. We're not helpless. We're not powerless. We're not doomed. We can slow down climate change. We can have a big say in designing the kind of planet that we want and that we need to survive. I think we have a lot of choices. And we still have time to offset the damage that we've done. And the part of the reason I feel this way is because human beings are imaginative, strong-willed problem solvers. We always have been. What we can't afford to do is wallow in denial or despair or depression about our plight. It's very easy to do that because we're being asked to make a lot of sacrifices now for against uncertain losses in the future. And the brain really goes into paralysis. It doesn't want to deal with that. It's like contemplating your own death.
Well, you write about a lot of things that I want to get into with you that do give you hope.
Uh-huh.
But before we do that, just wondering, we had Larry Diamond, a foreign affairs analyst who's at Hoover, on, and we got into this discussion about, we're talking about ISIS and about some of the terrible things that are afflicting the world now in terms of war, the recent temporary peace now between Hamas and Israel, but a lot of real barbarism and carnage. Ukraine is flaming up again. It prompted us to talk about, well, actually, Larry talked about it. And since you're a naturalist, you think a lot about questions of nature and nurture and what we do to nature. But he was maybe saying that there's something in our DNA that inclines us toward this kind of ferocity and this kind of maybe even barbarism that flares up in different places on the planet at different times.
There are two aspects to that, I think. One is that we are animals, and unfortunately, genocide is something that takes place all across various species of animals. You know, a lion, a male lion will come in and he will kill the other male, but he will also kill the offspring and impregnate the female so that only his genes will continue. And there are other animals that do that. The difference is that we don't always play by nature's rules. We've proven that. We have the awareness now to stop and ask ourselves what kind of a species we want to be exactly. But aside from that, we also know now, just in the last 10 years, about epigenetics. And these are little tags that get put on the DNA that make certain genes fire and not fire. And what we're learning now is that what happened to your grandmother can affect your health and well-being. What happens to you if you're exposed to war, if you are exposed to hunger or violence, not only will that disturb you now and your children, it will also be carried on to their children. This kind of awareness of how we function on that level is something that needs to be better known. We need to understand how important humanitarian projects really are and how important resisting the kinds of evil side of our nature really are.
Well, one could get pretty pessimistic about epigenetics, I suppose, or feel deterministic about it. But let me just get back to a point you made about animal genocide, because Jeff Mason, for example, who has distinguished himself as an animal rights activist of major stature, was on this program not long ago saying, and I'm notwithstanding what you said about lions or what we know about some of our simian or primate cousins, that animal genocide, he felt, doesn't exist in the way it does with humans killing their own species.
It does exist, but there the technicality there is the in the way it does with humans. We have so much in common with other animals and the way they feel and the way they think, but we do all of that in much more complicated ways, and we can get passionate about really abstract things really fast and complicate it. We get so much bad news in the media, which tends to feature that, you know, the old if it bleeds, it leads maxim, that we could get a distorted sense of what human beings really are like. I don't think human beings are evil. I think that mercy and heroism function as an equally large facet of our nature, even a larger facet. We just don't hear about those things very often.
Talking with Diane Ackerman, her new book is The Human Age, and she's also the author of The Zookeeper's Wife and An Alchemy of Mind, and we're going to be talking about, I hope, a lot of things, including maybe even Walt Whitman before this hour is over, because I want to infuse this with some optimism. And I went back and listened to an interview with you about Whitman a number of years ago. Well, actually, maybe we should talk about that now, because he really did believe in human beings, and he believed in the sense of the possibilities, the almost limitless possibilities of human beings, even going out to the cosmic realms. And you were saying in this interview that, well, it's not only a love of life, but a sense of the duty that Whitman had. I'll quote you now, throwing a bucket full of light onto the commonest of things that makes him so exhilarating and makes him so filled with a kind of bountiful, sanguine feeling that the world can be the better world and we can create it.
I love that about Whitman, and I love that he was really the first American poet that the universe and technology didn't scare. He welcomed it all. You know, for him, everything human was a cause of fascination, and he took to electricity immediately. Remember when he sang The Body Electric? I think he'd be rather stunned at the discoveries we have now that we really do have electricity in our bodies and that we're creating fabrics where you can just plug in your devices into your clothes and stuff and they'll get charged. But He had one of the largest sensibilities of any American poet.
And was linked to the people, was linked to democratic idealism, all of those kinds of things, which are certainly, for many of us, the brighter side of what the human experiment has been all about. We can come back to Whitman, but let me go to some of the things that you find optimistic, just that are very much in the zeitgeist now or in the world of technological invention and the like. I was talking about our simian cousins before. You spend some time talking about apps for apes over in the Toronto Zoo.
Oh, that's really wonderful. Well, through our new technology, we have been discovering that the minds of animals very often are like ours, and that some animals, like orangutans, for instance, are really smart. They have the intelligence of 3 to 4 year olds. So when they're in the zoo, we need to make sure that they have things to keep them occupied and so on. And so I went to visit a program called Apps for Apes, where they give iPads to orangutans. And I visited a wonderful one named Booty, who kind of hosts the book, and he was playing with it. He also can Skype on it. And Peter Gabriel is at work on an internet for interspecies, so that various animals, if they want to, they wouldn't be forced to, could take advantage of communicating with their kin or their friends in the same way that we do.
And you see that as, again, a part of this more optimistic strain of where we might be headed in terms of what technology can do?
I think that it's optimistic in the sense that we have begun to understand the other creatures that we share the planet with in ways that enrich our own lives and will help us protect them. And the protection even extends to making their lives more comfortable through our technology. But it's, I also included it because it's an example of how completely the digital revolution has changed us. It's changed us physically. It's changed our eyesight. It's changed lots of things about us. But it also has persuaded us that we now have this other self, which is the digital self, and we want to be able to extend all of that sense of ourselves now to other animals on the planet.
We've also, as I said in the billboard to this morning's program, collected DNA of vanishing species, manufactured body organs from 3D prints, gone to great lengths to restore ecosystems, all of these things that you touch on. One of the things that I found most fascinating, particularly in light of climate change, if we could move this forward, is actually harnessing body heat to wind energy. And this being done in Europe.
Oh, it is all over Europe. In Scandinavia, in France. The idea is that human beings give off about 100 watts of power. So why not harness that energy? Especially in subway places, platforms, where you have all of these people crowded together and they're in a hurry and they're giving off all of this heat, which can be collected, is being collected, and shunted below ground to heat water, which then goes through pipes across the street, other places, to provide heat in office buildings. And it all gets turned into a cooperative cycle where what people are doing in one part of the city is helping to provide energy for what people are doing in another part of the city. Wind energy from trains passing by is something that is being used in China and other places. There are so many fascinating sustainability things going on. That's one of the reasons that I'm so hopeful. We know how to build zero carbon buildings now.
I'm also thinking about what you write about the Maldives, because we did a program based on a film that was done that said essentially climate change is going to render that whole nation, and it is a nation, underwater, put it underwater, just like many of those who are talking about extinction say, we're going to be a bunch of jellyfish and Argentine ants before long. But the Maldives is a fascinating example because they're going to be essentially carbon neutral by 2020 now?
Yes. It's odd that such a small nation could be really leading the world in this. But as you say, they're deeply invested in their future, and they've committed themselves. It's a little bit easier now because solar and wind power are becoming cheaper, faster than anybody expected. But also because we are evolving at a mind-boggling pace. And so are our inventions. We have the tools and we have the ingenuity that we need to bring about this kind of sustainable future.
Well, let's talk about, for example, we've done a number of shows on – we did one recently on invasive species. We've done, as I said, shows on the next extinction and all that. You profile this French botanist who's actually researching invasive species and doing something to repair the ecosystem damage. Talk about that.
Yes, he's quite wonderful. But it is something that's happening all over the world. His name is Patrick Blanc, and he is really the pioneer of vertical gardens. More and more human beings are moving into cities. We are very quickly becoming an urban species. That's going to happen in just the next couple of decades, where almost all human beings will be living in cities. So then the question arises, how do we retain a sense of nature? How do we offset the pollution and so on of living that close together? Well, one of the ways is to bring nature right in with us, to plant rooftops that are alive and thriving and absorbing the carbon dioxide, to plant up the sides, not just the outsides of buildings, but the insides of buildings too, with meadows. I've seen some of them, and they're magnificent. They actually freshen the air around you.
We not only have rooftop farming, we have urban farming thanks to – well, in fact, there's a local Oakland writer named Novella Carpenter who's been featured on the Forum program who's been advancing that and doing sort of wonderful things with it. I mean, these kinds of things are really exciting, and they also bring up a bigger question, though, that I want to get to with you. And again, we're talking with Diane Ackerman and talking about her newest book, which is called The Human Age, a reflection on how people have changed, how the planet has changed. There's also this movement from the Holocene era, the geologists talked about, to the Anthropocene era, which is a name that I guess comes from Paul Crutzen, doesn't it?
Yes.
This is the idea that we're literally in a different epoch now. It's created a lot of controversy, too, about how we measure not only our existence, but how we judge, for example, geology and archaeology and all of those kinds of things.
I think it's a very important name for us to adopt. Probably it will be adopted by 2016. They're just debating now essentially when it should start with the agricultural revolution, with nuclear weapons, when exactly with the industrial revolution. But the plain fact is that we've been on the planet for hundreds of thousands of years, and in only the past 200 years – we have become the dominant source of change on the planet. We've totally altered the climate, the oceans, the continents. We've lopped off the tops of mountains. We've cleared forests. We've moved plants and animals all around the planet. Our impact is so profound that, yes, they want to change the name of the era in which we live from its geological designation, as you say, Holocene, to one that better conveys what's happening, the Anthropocene, which translates as the human age.
And the geologists are not happy about this, Diane, I don't think, are they?
Some are.
Yeah.
Some are very happy about this. The real issue is when to start it. And it's already been adopted by an enormous number of scientists in their literature all over the world. And there is a consensus that the world dramatically changed with the Industrial Revolution's factories and fossil fuel use. And that's when we really started changing the planet on a grand scale.
I think some of the geologists who are resistant, though, talk about archaeological ways of looking at the past as changing and therefore perhaps, I don't know, eclipsing the way things have been done traditionally and the way things from their perspective ought to be done.
Well, it's a question of weighing what's most valuable. But even in those terms, I mean, I think it's extremely valuable to highlight the impact that we're having on the planet at precisely this moment when we've achieved this awe-inspiring mastery, and we're also discovering that we're endangering the planet as a result by giving it a name. That's going to help. But be that as it may, we are leaving our tracks in the fossil record. It will be absolutely clear to future geologists millions of years hence, and I believe there will be such. They may not live on the planet, but if they come to visit, it'll be clear where our era began. I think it will probably be with the Industrial Age. And from then on, they're going to see how there used to be, before then, such a variety of plants and animals all over the world. Suddenly, there's monoculture of agriculture, monoculture of animals, just a few interbred clans. Plants and animals that used to live on one continent suddenly live on other continents. All of a sudden, there are our metals and our plastics and things that don't really degrade that we've left, and our brand new forms of matter that we've created. We will leave our tracks in the fossil record.
Won't this affect the way we study our fossil records, though?
It will. The textbooks are going to have to be rewritten.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll have to decide, what are we going to call this exactly? Are we going to say it's an epic? How are we going to designate this period? We're in the Holocene, which is like the last 11,000 years. But it's only because we're at right on the edge of the Anthropocene. How long is it going to last? It could go on for a very long time.
Again, we're talking to Diane Ackerman. Her new book is The Human Age. I'm going to invite those of you listening to join us. In fact, we would like to hear from you and have you join this conversation, talking about her new book, The Human Age, but also talking about, as we tend to do, a range of other things. Even brought Whitman into the mix here, and would like to hear from listeners. And if you have something you'd like to bring to the conversation, or if you have a question or comment, now would be the time. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address is simply forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments you might have immediately onto the website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm looking actually at an email here, Diane, from Noam. We're coming up on a break, but he says, one of the undiscussed sources of so many of the problems you're discussing is overpopulation. I'd love to hear Diane's comments on overpopulation as we go into the break. Diane?
There's no question. Overpopulation is a big problem, and I don't have a simple answer for it, unfortunately. I don't think anybody does. It's going to be something that we're going to have to deal with in the coming days. We're either going to have a less population, or we're going to have richer sources of resources to be able to take care of everyone.
Well, we'll go to our to our break here, but we'll come back to that and other questions. And again, you can join us. Toll-free number is available. Are you optimistic about the future of the planet, about the future of the human race? That really is where we are at here in a very elemental way in this discussion. Join us at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. And talking about a lot of new and exciting things also that are in the book I haven't even touched on. Bioengineering, for example, which Diane writes about, among many other things in her book. But feel free to join us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with award-winning poet, essayist, and naturalist Diane Ackerman. Her new book is The Human Age, and it's a reflection on how people have changed the planet. And she writes, quote, our relationship with nature has changed radically, irreversibly, but by no means all for the bad. That kind of sums up, I think, a lot of the attitude that the book has with its with the usual sort of wonder and awe that we associate with this particular poet and writer. And she pretty much comes down, you heard her before say that she expects to maybe be looking back, perhaps from another planet, but at this planet a million years from now, that somehow we will survive. We're in a brave new world, as Huxley told us, but what of that brave new world in terms of the human species and the survival of the human species? optimism, pessimism on a continuum? Are you guardedly pessimistic? Guardedly optimistic? Or are you perhaps somewhere in between the two? Like to hear from some listeners on this, and you can also join us to talk about really anything we're talking about, including Walt Whitman, that great poet and author of Leaves of Grass. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or questions or comments can be posted on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And there are many exciting things in this new book that I think many of you perhaps may want to know more about, that is manufacturing body organs from 3D prints and the kind of lengths they're going to, that humans are going to restore ecosystems. But, of course, we all know that there are problems, and problems like overpopulation that the caller brought up before we went to the break. You want to add something to that, Diane? Not really,
except to say that we're going to have our work cut out for us because you have some religions on one side of not curbing population, and you have a lot of planetary scientists on the other side of it. I don't have a simple answer for it. One of the things, though, that I wanted to add, if I may, is that one of the key reasons for writing the book was you had mentioned Whitman and throwing light into dark corners. We take so much for granted about being human these days without realizing that we're nothing like the way humans used to be. We've all become superheroes. We just take it so much for granted that we can move through the sky at 500 miles an hour or safely repair somebody's heart or see a hawk across the valley and so on, or that we can add metal to our legs to strengthen them or put pig valves in our heart. We find all of this perfectly normal.
I find all of it wonderful and amazing, and I share your feeling of being inspired, but I also open the paper and I read about people in Iraq and Syria who are chopping off heads. I mean, you know, we go.
I feel the same way about that. I feel the same way, and I'm not being a Pollyanna about this. I'm a real climate realist and anti-war realist. But you don't have to give up your sense of wonder just because you are loathing and despising the evil that is taking place in the world. What can happen is that that's all we focus on. And we don't appreciate all the rest of it, going on at the same time.
It blots out the light for many of us, doesn't it?
It blots out the light, and then you get a very warped sense of what human beings are like.
Well, we're going to go to our callers and find out what they want to talk about. I should mention that Diane Ackerman will be appearing at the California Academy of Sciences on September 17th and Book Passage in Corte Madera on September 18th and at a KPFA event in Berkeley later that same evening of September 18th. Let me go to your calls. Andrew, you're first up here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for talking about this very important issue. I had a couple of quick points. You've mentioned about humanity. You've mentioned about the fact that we are far beyond where we were. Quickly, one point I'd like to address is that we're not really going to solve the larger problems until we come together as a species and recognize that we are humans trying to survive on this planet. But what I really wanted to ask you about was the unintended consequences of technological advances that originally were meant to make a more beneficial environments for both us and what have you. The main case in point would be the introduction of nitrogen-based fertilizer, which ended up, allowing larger populations of people to be fed, but ended up also leading to things like runoff waste, dead zones, and toxic algae blooms.
Yeah, it's an excellent example, and there are a legion number of them, Diane.
Yeah, so there were really two questions there, and I'll give you two quick answers. The internet and the digital revolution brought with it globalization and the awareness that you can influence people all over the world and that you have a lot in common with them. Climate change is bringing about, I think, a different kind of globalization. It's teaching us about the interrelatedness of humans to the rest of nature all over the planet and how vital it's going to be for us to work together and for countries that are even rivals to be coming together on issues having to do with the health of the planet. That's number one. In the past, we were doing everything accidentally. We didn't really know what we were doing. We weren't paying attention to it. One of our great traits now is our self-awareness. We're suddenly stopping. And this is another good reason for adopting the name of the either the Anthropocene or the Human Age, because it makes us stop and say, wait a minute, we need to have some oversight on some of these technological things. How about all of the silver nanoparticles that people now are able to coat, let's say, hospital things with? You're able to coat fabric, you're able to coat furniture with it. But unfortunately, it could also kill the good bacteria that we need. And in only the past 10, 20 years, we're discovering that most of our own bodies really is DNA from bacteria, not human DNA. So we don't want to go messing around with killing all of the bacteria every place. We are creating predicaments that we just never got into before. And almost certainly there will have to be committees of ethics departments of biomedical and other ethics, sitting down and trying to figure out what kind of a species are we really? Who are we? What are we? What do we want to be? How are we going to bring that about? What do we need to keep our eyes on? What can we really take advantage of? Because it's going to make the medical life so much better for so many people.
Well, when I think about unintended consequences, I also think about some of the species that are brought in. I mean, you go back to the classic example of starlings, but, you know, we have global trade now and all these pathways have opened up and globalization has made things, as you say, so much. But we've brought in all kinds of invasive species as a result as well.
However, do bear in mind that we are the most invasive species of all and that we've also brought in a lot of invasive species we really like. I love my rose bushes and my apple trees and tulips and lots of other invasive species. I love horses. There's one too. But we have decided at this stage in our evolution, we have become so powerful that we can decide what plants and animals we want to share the planet with. That gives us an enormous amount of power. It should fill us with astonishment at how majestic we've become, but it also should give us a sense of responsibility now. We have to make a lot of very hard decisions.
And we'll go to another caller, and that's you, Sarah. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I really appreciate this conversation, and I think deeply about these things as a climate scientist almost every day. And I wanted to call in with just a reflection from my community in academia and the level of apathy and sort of heartbrokenness that I see amongst climate science scientists and environmental scientists. And I think it reflects a broader need for us to develop an emotional sort of language and capacity to deal with such large problems. And one of the ways that I think about this, about the future, as a mother of a 10-month-old little boy, is that his life in the future, yes, the planet will be very different, the planet of his adult life, really dramatically different. But we will still love each other. We will still have music. The world will still be beautiful. There's really important reasons to remember that our planet is very valuable and that we as people can tap in to a very deep emotional well to fuel the energy to address these kind of problems. So I just wanted to add that to the conversation.
Yeah, and I'm glad you did, and I thank you for that, Sarah. Response from you, Diane Ackerman?
Yeah, I agree entirely. The language that's being used is paralyzing people. No one is going to want to do anything if they're confronted with doom and gloom the whole time. it's much more important that we stay very positive, that we focus on the things we can change, that we do absolutely everything we can as individuals. And those can be pretty small things, you know, biking and walking instead of driving and using public transportation and recycling. But for the youngest among us, it can also be a question of rolling up your sleeves. I would love to see the VISTA program reanimated. Remember VISTA?
I do. I had an aunt who joined VISTA. One of my mother's sisters actually joined VISTA. It was a Volunteers in Service to America.
Yeah,
kind of group that went into poverty areas and did that sort of roll up the sleeve stuff you talked about. Yeah.
I would like it to come about again. So that students, when they get out of high school, don't go directly into college. I certainly wasn't ready for that, and not many people are, but instead have to do a year in a VISTA environmental core. They would be cooperating with other people. A caller called about that, and we have now become almost like a single organism spreading all over the planet. We need to cooperate with each other on these planetary problems that we've all brought about. They would get a lot of education that way. They would be out in the world and see things hands-on for real. And they would be doing a lot of good for the planet. I think that would be helpful. But there are still so many things that your listeners can be doing. I mean, they can volunteer to help build a wildlife corridor or rails-to-trail corridor. They could get involved with an urban farm. There are many things. We're not helpless. And this idea that's being perpetuated that we are going to hell in a handbasket, there's nothing we can do about it, so throw up your hands. Why bother? I don't think that's factual.
Maybe it's not so much hell in a handbasket as it is what the caller alluded to, apathy. I mean, that's the things you're talking about appeal to many of those in the choir that you know, are on your side and see things the way you do. But there are many people who just don't feel that they want to be involved or don't care enough to be involved.
Well, this is part of the reason why we need to draw attention to this new age that we have made. It is some people are calling it a man-made age. I would prefer to call it a human-made age. We have crafted it ourselves. We've brought about a lot of chaos, and we can undo it to a large extent. It won't be exactly the same planet, but we can nonetheless create a restorative, healthy future for ourselves and future generations. And if we make some of the enterprises very visible so that they have a cachet to taking part in them, make them fun, I think we can bring that about even among the apathetic ones out there. But we still do have a lot of work to do.
Well, let me read an email from a listener since we've been talking about the Anthropocene. This is John. It says, both raising the issue of overpopulation and the naming of the Anthropocene implies that all humans equally burden the Earth's resources or were equally involved in altering the geological record. Fact is that Euro-American capitalist transition, which involved the rapacious pursuit of wealth and resources from all over the globe and the subjugation of peoples who lived very resource-light, lives. Today, overpopulation implies excess poor people in developing countries, where in fact the developed countries and their capitalist classes' pursuit of profit are the real strain on resources.
Well, that's absolutely true. But fortunately, the developed countries also are setting goals and adopting renewables pretty fast, too. But it's not just the developing, rather the developed country. I mean, Peru recently gave 500,000 of its poorest people access to solar electricity, and solar and wind power are becoming cheap enough to switch to all over. The new prime minister of India recently announced a very ambitious plan that he was going to transition all 400 million Indians to solar power. He's already started planting 2 billion trees along the highways, which he points out will provide jobs for 300,000 of people who are unemployed and help to curb the CO2, and doing lots of other things like that. Yes, certainly the developed countries are creating most of it, and the burden is on us, and we need to get busy. But it's going to have to be a global process. One of the biggest things that can be taking place in a lot of not necessarily very sophisticated areas is planting trees. There's been research showing that if we reforested all of the Australian outback and the Sahara, I know that isn't easy, but it is technologically possible.
But look what Wangari Maathai has done. I mean, the late Wangari Maathai, who won the Nobel Prize, who I'm sure you're familiar with, who's been on this program a couple of times, or was on this program when she was alive. I mean, just the number of trees that were planted and that were forested is absolutely remarkable. And those of you who are not familiar with her, I really commend you to look her up online, Maathai, Wangari.
Yes.
A listener writes, I love your guest positivity. How does she personally brush off all the negativity of others? I think you're giving us the answer to that as you respond to some of the remarks and thoughts that are here in this discussion. In fact, let me go to a listener who is, I think, David has some criticism, I think. Go ahead.
Greetings. Well, first I want to applaud Ms. Ackerman for her optimism and her, you know, can-do and her applause for technological change, which combined with human action and smart policies can fix a lot of the problems she's diagnosing. However, I must ask you and her to correct the scientific and historical and economic record, which she's really shredding pretty badly. Here are a few examples. Number one, she mentions that humans are the most destructive force in terms of biological despeciation on the world. That is just historically not true, and anybody can Google it and find out that about 99% of all species that have ever existed on Earth were destroyed by natural evolutionary changes, not by humans. The Ice Age, the comets that hit the Earth, all those things were far more impactful than humans, like orders and orders of magnitude more, number one. Number two, we're not overpopulating the world. We're about to start depopulating the world so rapidly that most of the industrialized welfare governments will crash under the social system expenses that will have small inverted demographic pyramids. In other words, you'll have a lot of old people trying to be supported by a few young people. It won't work. It's a disaster. We need to have more babies, not fewer. Number three, on the issues of economics, anything that the Maldives does for social, for global warming is irrelevant. They are too small. They have no material impact on the globe's climate. Only China has any impact there. The main thing we can get them to do quickly would be to move from coal to natural gas. That would cut their emissions by at least 50% immediately. That would be a better way to go. So I'd like Ms. Ackerman to look a little bit more at economics, a little bit more history, a little bit more at science, and then I applaud her well because she has a good heart.
Well, David, I'm struck by your points. They do bring light, and they are intelligent and thoughtful. He also gave you your props there. Diane Ackerman, respond.
Yes, I'm sorry. I must have not made how I feel exactly clear enough. I don't think we are the most powerful source of change ever on the planet. Blue-green algae did a really good job long, long time ago. No, it's right now what has been happening in the last 200 years, and it's the pace of it. There are those issues. I don't know about population control, so I'm going to just take your word on that, and I'm glad that
that's a tough, thorny question, though, because the more we he may be right about depopulating, but the population problem is still of great concern in terms of carrying capacity and consumption and sustainability and all of those kinds of things. But what about the last point that he raises, though?
Yeah, the Maldives, of course, is not going to make a big difference. It is.
Well, China was really the point, I think, more than
China is the point. Yeah. And the Obama White House, China, they are in conversations now about what they can do. For example, stop subsidizing coal. I know that China is continuing to build coal plants at the same time that they are leading the world in equipment for renewables of all different kinds. But their population is getting sicker and sicker because of the smog pollution that they have, and they clearly need to address this. And they claim that they are going to also be very actively pursuing this commitment to renewables and getting out of coal. So, but you're quite right. It's created a health hazard and it claims to be vigorously switching, and we need to continue lobbying with them to make that change.
We're talking, once again, if you've just joined us, with Diane Ackerman, a naturalist and poet and author, and in fact, her new book is called The Human Age. I'm going to go to another caller here, and let's welcome Kania. Is it Kania or Kani?
It is Kania.
Kania, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, I'm really glad you guys are having a conversation like this. It's refreshing to hear some positivity out of all the pessimism. I was an environmental studies major at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and so I felt like I was just always bombarded with bad news. But also, you know, it's very easy to think about humans as being intentionally destructive, and I think Diane was kind of touching on this point as well. But the Industrial Revolution, for example, didn't come with the intention of completely devastating Earth and its resources. It's just an accident that kind of happened, and it grew and grew. And I think that if we have that potential of destruction, we can also have that potential of salvation. And I think the world that's getting more and more globalized comes with some benefits as well, like social media. We have this huge platform that we can use now to our advantage outside of the mainstream media to get this information and this positivity out there. So I appreciate this conversation, and Diane, thank you for your book.
And I appreciate your call, and you know,
I do too.
Diane, you do have a good heart, as the caller said before. And, in fact, I was very, in many ways, inspired by your book about your husband Paul, and we talked about that on forum. It's in our archives, and it's a love story and a very compelling love story. And I have a listener here who wants to, he said, just since we're talking about positive and inspiring things, could you please ask Ms. Ackerman about her adventure to the island of Torishima to see short-tailed albatross and Hiroshi Hasegawa? And it's an inspirational story. That's from Beyond the Archives, yeah?
Yes, it certainly is. For a number of years, I was traveling around the planet working with endangered animals, and I wanted to see the last of the short-tailed albatrosses, which live on a very remote, small island that is an active volcano. And I went there with two birders who unfortunately didn't tell me we'd be doing cliff climbing. So I got there, they handed me a rope, said, put it behind your back, and we're going to let ourselves down this 1,000-foot, 400-foot cliff. And I wasn't strong enough. And the rope opened up, I slammed against the rock face, I broke three ribs, and then I was really in trouble and was very close to death. It was quite a remarkable time. But I got to see the albatrosses. You know,
you could have worn it around your neck like the Ancient Mariner from the experience
you
went through.
It's so true. Who would drink from a cup when you can drink from the source? That's the way that I've always felt, whether you go out far into nature or just into the nature of your backyard. And ultimately, obviously, I lived through it. It was quite a saga, and I got to help save the albatrosses. But you don't need to go to the ends of the earth to find the marvelous and to have that kind of life-changing adventure. I find it in the backyard, and people can. One of the predicaments that we're finding in our wonderful digital age, I love the internet and social media and all of that, but one of the problems is that so many people are now experiencing nature virtually, only virtually, and not also going outside and having it confront all of their senses. And it's really important for our health and well-being that we do that.
Yeah, we did a whole program on virtual reality, and the thought that occurred to me is people will experience nature right on their couches without necessarily having to move once they put those goggles on and experience it in whatever way. But I'm always struck by just how filled with optimism you are. I mean, breaking three ribs, you know, somebody could come back from an experience like that and not talk about it with the cheerfulness and the upbeat nature of what you've just described. It reminds me of a program we recently also did on happiness and on so-called positive psychology. And there was a story, it was an article in The Atlantic by our guest, Joshua Schenck. And he writes about, this is not just apocryphal, apparently this father put two socks by a chimney and one had a new watch in it and the other had a lot of horse manure. And the kid who took the sock with the watch said, "Dad, I don't know if I can get the set right. It's too fragile. I don't know how to keep it." And so, The little kid, these were rather small kids who got the horse manure, said, "Does this mean I'm going to get a pony?" I just found that kind of compelling, as you can imagine.
Well, that is compelling. And probably it you know, it's helpful if listeners know that I don't have a perfectly happy all the time life. I'm a full-time caregiver. My husband is in a wheelchair. He's still my little wombat at 84, and I adore him. And that's the book you were talking about, 100 Names for Love, earlier. And I do see a lot of horrors that go on, and it fills me with terrible upset. But it does not fill me with despair, because I see the other side of human nature. As the previous caller was saying, to a large extent, it's our inventiveness that got us into this mess. It was accidental.
Oh, you're indefatigable. Let's just say it like it is. You are indefatigable, and it's always a great pleasure to have you with us on Forum. We're coming to the end of the hour, but I really appreciate the time you've spent with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
The book,
it's been a delight,
is The Human Agent. Just a quick note from a listener. Says, "I was a Vista volunteer, served in a fair housing center in Detroit in the 70s. My son served as an AmeriCorps in Forest City, and says AmeriCorps does great conservation projects, plants trees and the like." Thank you to those behind the scenes here. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Want to extend thanks also for production assistance to Suzanne Breton and Vinny Tong, who were with us this week. Engineer is Howard Gelman. I'm Michael Kresge.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.